Welcome to Body Signals, a Cygnos podcast. I'm your host, Bill Tanzer, Chief Data Scientist here at Cygnos. This is Season 4, Episode 8, The Secrets to a Good Night's Sleep, and why sleep is so necessary on your wellness weight loss journey. On this episode, I'm joined by Molly Eastman, the creator of Sleep is a Skill and host of Sleep is a Skill podcast. On this episode, we discuss what drove Molly to devote her career to helping others get a good night's sleep, the importance of the sleep tripod, how she addresses the multifactorial nature of sleep problems with her clients, glucose dysregulation and how it can disrupt sleep, and you'll want to wait to the end of this episode to hear Molly's top five tips to a better night's sleep. This and so much more. Now on to today's show. Welcome back to Body Signals. I am so thrilled to have Molly Eastman here on today's episode. For those of you who don't know Molly, Molly is the creator of Sleep is a Skill, a company and a podcast. The company helps people optimize their sleep through technology, accountability, and behavior change. And she's also the host of Sleep is a Skill podcast. And if you haven't checked out this podcast yet, she's got over 100 episodes. And I have to tell you, Molly, I was really into my sleep schedule, and I have been for months now. And I started binging your episodes last night. And I looked at the clock, and it was 10 o'clock. And my rule is to wind down at 9. And by 9:30, I'm off to sleep because I wake up early. And I looked at the clock, it was like 10, then it was like 10:30. I'm like, okay, I've got to stop. And it's kind of ironic that I'm losing sleep listening to a podcast, the title being Sleep is a Skill.
That is amazing. Oh my God. Well, I'm sorry it had that impact, but I hope in the long term, any takeaways you got can support your sleep, hopefully, minus that initial detriment. Apologies.
Yeah, I highly recommend Sleep as a Skill, the podcast, and the business too, but the podcast I can vouch for because it's such great content. I mean, over 100 episodes with all of these experts concentrating on sleep. We talk a bit about sleep on Body Signals. It really is important for our listeners who are interested in weight loss and wellness and glucose and the interdependency. And I've talked a bit about how sleep can impact glucose. So it is just, it's so exciting to have you. And I've got so many questions for you.
Amazing.
But the first one I have, I just have to know how you got how you were inspired to start your company and this podcast that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's pertinent to the listener, I hope, because I hope it can stand as an example of no matter where someone might be at in their relationship to their sleep, whether they might be really struggling or they aren't thinking too much about their sleep, wherever they might fall, to know that they're really take the stance that there is always a something that we can bring in to make a difference with your sleep results from a skill set perspective. That's why we really stand that sleep is a skill in our modern society, because we've gotten so far off kilter with some of the things that can make a difference. So with my story, I hope that it speaks to that point. And when I think about sleep, I really think about it as a three-part story in my life. And what that's looked like is, on the front end, in the first half of my life, I just had a lot of fixed narratives and labels around how I related to my sleep. And what that looked like was, I would say, I'm a short sleeper, I'm a night owl, it's in my genes, I'll sleep when I'm dead, all of these ways of relating and navigating sleep, but really from a place of, this is the lot in life I have. It's kind of, it's just the way it is for me. Nothing to really do there, just to survive it and deal with it. And that's all there is. Not correlating as time went on and as my behaviors became more extreme as far as this justification and rationalization that I'm a night owl. So I get my best work done at night. So I'm going to set up life to facilitate that. And I would go to bed later and later. And I did not correlate as time went on through high school, college, early 20s, what have you, that I was getting more and more anxious, more physical symptoms, getting the beginnings of an ulcer, got shingles in my 20s, you know, all of these signs that how I was managing things probably weren't working and was not correlating sleep. And as a serial entrepreneur in Manhattan, burning the candle at both ends, what ended up happening over time was then I was met with this experience of insomnia. And of course, it didn't come out of nowhere. It came from just a continuation of managing my health and my sleep and my life and my nervous system in such a way that resulted in this experience of insomnia. Now, how that looked was a la Tim Ferriss inspiration, decided to put everything in storage, take all, you know, these businesses on the road before they were really ready. The level of stress was very high. And my first real experience with jet lag, I'd never really experienced much jet lag, grew up with not a lot of money and didn't travel a ton. So it's experienced jet lag when traveling into Europe. And then my maladaptive behaviors and stress load, that's when I began to have my first experience with insomnia. And I never really experienced that before to that level. And what that did was really shook me to the core. It was really a rock bottom in my life. Just a lot of things weren't working. And so I went to the doctors in Croatia with Google Translate and I said, help, I can't sleep. And I leave with sleeping pills. And in that moment, realizing like, okay, I've got to really take this on. And I do now have permission from my mom to share part of what was in the background for me, which is that she went through a whole period of going down a path of prescription medications and really had a, you know, a difficult experience on that path. So when that happened for me, it was a even more activating because it was a moment of, oh no, is this going to be my reality? Am I stepping into that same path? So the stakes were high for me. And so it felt as if, okay, I've got to really figure this out. So what that looked like was embarking on this journey of what does it take to get great sleep, and tested and tried a ton of things, spent a lot of money, spent a lot of time to figure this area out. On the other side of it, what ended up coming out was this connection to this world of chronobiology, the science of time and how time affects your biology. And then this sense of like, why are we not all talking about this? I truly believe that this is going to be one of the next big movements in health and wellness. So I speak to this a lot. And but in the process of just having a practical application and shifting my behaviors and my environment and my life to facilitate this changed everything for me. So I couldn't stop talking about it. So organically, these kind of small groups got formed, almost like, you know, small support groups kind of deal. And then it grew into online courses. I had a background in communications and behavioral change. So it was a natural kind of, you know, complement. And so started building these courses. So out of that, now we have 10-week long programs that people go through to help optimize their sleep through some of the things that, you know, we'll likely talk about today, as well as the creation of the podcast, which now we're the number 2 sleep podcast. So I say that just because it's so wild from where we came from to what's gotten created. Like, it's still wild to me. And then we have weekly newsletters that we've done every single Monday. We haven't missed a Monday for over 4 years, where we're really committed to giving lots of free information for people to really get in the game of, we like to think of it as a way of gamifying sleep and actually, hopefully, dare I say, make it fun. So out of that process, we've now are interacting with thousands of people on a routine basis around their sleep. We have a particular niche in poker. So we work with a lot of high stakes poker players to really get them the edge in their performance through optimizing their sleep, as well as other high performers and regular people looking to make a difference in this area, as well as the sports kind of moving into the realm of sports performance and hospitality. So I say all that because no matter where you're at with your sleep, we can absolutely make a difference with it. And I think that's one of the most important takeaways I hope to leave, you know, with that story.
Well, there's so much to unpack there, but I have to start with the fact that you and I went down the same track, at least in my 30s and 40s. I convinced myself I was a short sleeper. Yeah. I thought to myself, I must be genetically wired to be a short sleeper. I slept maybe 3 to 4 hours. I viewed sleep as an inconvenient reality, something Same. That I had to do, but I could get by with those 3 to 4 hours and perform enough. And it started, I guess, yeah, it was in my 50s. As I started my 50s, I started to realize, nope, not true. Doesn't work. When I joined Cygnos, when I started at Cygnos and started measuring my glucose, I started paying attention to a number of different factors. And then I started to see the impact that short sleep actually had. And a side note, I've been doing a lot of research on short sleep. It's estimated only 1 to 3% of the population have the gene for short sleep.
Yes.
So there's a chance you might be a short sleeper if you get 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night and can survive. But if I were a poker player, if I were a bettor, I would Yes. be probably placing my money on the fact you're part of the 99% of us who are not short sleepers. So
yes, most likely. Exactly. So statistically, it's highly unlikely that that is the case for individuals. And then also, no matter what the sleep duration, there's so much that we can do from a sleep quality perspective. So from the regularity, how fragmented your sleep is, that duration piece, and just that overall quality aspect. So we can talk about all those. So no matter how much sleep you're getting, the quality of that comes into play.
Absolutely. I'm going to start with a skeptical question. So I'm going to play the skeptic and just ask, is sleep really a skill? Sometimes I feel it's like luck of the draw as a moderate to somewhat poor sleeper. Sometimes I think it's got a lot to do with my surroundings, maybe things outside of my control. So I want to get some more from you in terms of why sleep is actually a skill.
Yeah, so important. I'm so glad you started there. Because I think if we were to go into a time machine and go back in time to hunter-gatherer days, from our history, how we spent thousands and thousands of years, it might have been a harder argument to sell because we were so aligned with the rhythms of nature and some of the things that we'll speak not from a woo perspective, but from a biological hardwiring perspective. That we were aligned with so many cues that tell the body what time it is and what to be doing when, they were naturally just fell into place. And I think for many of us, what we don't realize is how divorced we are from those that kind of blueprint and how much of an impact it's making on our well-being. So this is one of the reasons, one of my big talks that I often give is around why I believe that circadian health and circadian wellness is going to be one of the next big things in our health psychology or in our health trends. And one of the reasons I believe that is because if we look at how we're living nowadays, back in 2001, the EPA did a study and it found that the average person was spending over 90% of their time inside. So it broke down to largely mainly inside a building and a little bit of time in automobiles. But all of that is within a particular container, divorced from these rhythms. And that was in 2001, before pandemic, smartphones, Netflix, all the things that likely could have been, probably were skewed even higher at this point. So why does that matter as we think about sleep? Well, it matters greatly because one of the things that we find is that now when we divorce ourselves from these rhythms, all of those original cues that we can get into that are known as Zeitgebers or time givers, these time givers communicate with our clocks, particularly our main clock known as our suprachiasmatic nucleus, that is really that conductor that communicates with these trillions of clocks in our peripheral cells and organs in our body to keep ourselves on time. And if we are not connected to those cues, one of the most important, and we can get into these, is light. So it's a huge one. And of course, its counterpart, darkness. So being cued up to those, as well as temperature, meal timing, other things that would have in the past just sort of happen at the times that as diurnal creatures meant to be active by day and at rest at night, all those things kind of would have happened in the appropriate times. However, now in this opportunity, since really Edison, we've had the opportunity to live a 24-hour lifestyle. certainly coming inside, having static thermostat where we've set everything at, you know, a nice, what, comfortable 72 degrees or whatever we've got going on. All of these things take away the cues and indicators to the body of what to be doing when. These have very real world results. So it will lower, for instance, your natural production of melatonin if you're not having the change in temperature and the change in lighting at the right times, just as an example. So it's a really long way to say that now in our modern society, because we are living outside of these rhythms so greatly, just even as part of our social network and social fabric. So for instance, the meal timing that we're engaging in, which is actually this conversation of meal timing, telling our circadian rhythm rhythms what time it is and what to be doing when, is even being tapped as potential Nobel Prize winning information out of the Salk Institute. So if anyone wants to look into this, The Circadian Code is a fantastic book that can share more about this. But when we think about the fact that, what do most of us do? We go out to socialize and we might go to an 8 o'clock dinner or what have you. Things of that nature are so outside of the scope of how we would have been living for thousands of years, hours and hours past sunset, to suddenly have plentiful food available and to be engaging in the ability to drink alcohol, to eat, to do all these things way past the times that we would have done them. That therein lies part of what it takes to be educated on what that's going to do to the body and do it our sleep-wake cycles. So as we learn all these things, that's where the skill set piece can come into play. And lastly, I'll also speak to the fact that just about every person that might be dealing with some sort of sleep disturbance likely has some element of nervous system dysregulation. So we see that time and time again. Now, there might be different reasons for the why. They might be crashing their blood sugar at different points, or there might be kind of real physiological root causes as well. But the result is that there's likely some nervous system dysregulation to greater or lesser degrees. So that's another piece that can come into the skill set element, is training the body and our nervous system response in a way that works for us and at the times that work for us, so that when we're laying in bed, stressing out, what have you, that we can hit the brakes on that sympathetic response at will and train that muscle to make that all happen. So my stance is that in our modern society, we have become so divorced from some of these natural ways of regulating the sleep-wake cycle, and it takes the learning and starting at sleep 101 to really make a difference.
You said so many great things there, and I want to get back to circadian rhythm, because we've actually done some experiments on that at Cygnos that we've got to talk about. But from what I'm hearing, it is a skill, but the challenge may be that it's a multifactorial problem. So there's all sorts of different things that's gone into this disconnect that we have from the way we were built and modern society, and how that has somehow interrupted how we sleep. So for one of your clients that join the Sleep Optimizer program, how do you address the multifactorial nature? Like, I imagine that each person that comes to you might have different issues. Like, I'm an open book with my listeners. They know that, well, I have an obsession with oatmeal, but we'll get to that later. But they know that I obsess on content. So I was binging your podcast last night, which probably interrupted my sleep. Probably not the best thing for me to listen to, because then my mind was racing of all the great questions I had to ask you about the content that was on your podcast. And that's interrupting my sleep cycle, right? But then there's other things. There's environmental factors, and there's behavioral issues. So how do you do the triage?
Yeah, great question. Okay, so what we do is, one, we do require that every person that we work with does have to wear the Oura Ring throughout their participation, and we stream through their data onto our dashboard. So we've amassed one of the largest databases of Oura Ring data from a sleep optimization perspective, not from a research perspective. Although we are bringing in some studies coming down the pike, but And what we do with that information is then, one, we are able to go through that in our cohorts, and routinely on every single call, we're able to look at each individual's stats to see what really is physically happening. So that's an element that's happening from almost an observer effect perspective, so that we get to have them benefit from the fact that they know that they're being observed, and often that changes behavior in and of itself. But having said that, we have a system that everyone goes through. So we have 10 weeks. The first 2 weeks are preparatory in nature. So within those 2 weeks, they are taking a whole intake. They do a lot of work on the first half. So they're intaking and going through tons of information and questions around their sleep behaviors. They're also sending over pictures of their sleep environment. Often they do videos as well. They're doing what we call our sleep sabotagers, which are 17 areas of life where they're kind of giving a self-assessment score and a little bit of detail on what's happening in various areas of their life that can be spilling into some of their stress response around their sleep from the psychological aspect. So we stand in this idea that there's a sleep tripod. So workability between your psychology, physiology, and environment. So we really tackle those three areas in the first 2 weeks. And so from there, then they're also going through answering what we call your and creating what we call your circadian crafted day. So they're choosing from, and this is after they've gone through some education piece of our generalized language and kind of vocabulary, pulling from the latest in chronobiology in particular. So there they make what we call the circadian crafted day, where they choose the consistent wake up time 7 days a week across the board, which is just for any listener, if you get nothing else out of what I'm saying, even if you were to begin there, choosing that consistent wake up time 7 days a week, right? Yes.
Absolutely.
I know I'm talking about a lot of stuff, but I want to also help to ensure that we get some practical takeaways for people, and I don't want to overwhelm because there are a lot of things. You said you nailed it. It's multifactorial. There are a lot of elements, but there are certain things that we know we can begin right away that can often make a difference for everyone. So 7 days a week, you choose that consistent wake up time plus or minus 30 minutes is really our goal. And then we can start to play the game of how is this working? So with that, people on their circadian crafted day will choose what time they're waking up, where they're going to get their bright light exposure, which we like to get that paired as quickly as possible to when they first wake up, how are they going to do that, what that's going to look like, where are they going to get their movement timing, because we can stack that ideally on the somewhere on the front half of the day, certainly when sunlight is still present is part of our goal there, as well as when is your meal timing going to come in, because that can make an important piece of when we're kind of beginning some of the activation of some of these clocks, so your first bite and your last bite of food. So we're just kind of, and we're not saying to, you're not trying to be neurotic or anything and have to get it particularly at this particular time, but we want to at least have some generalized consistency so that the body can prepare to know, oh, I'm going to get a whole plate of food at around this time, because it actually does do this preparation kind of in nature. So we want to help it. So we do all these things, and then we help to transform that environment just so we can be swimming in a setup and a and have your environment pull for your success. So once we begin that, that's when we start going into these Zeitgebers that are really put, those time givers put in order of importance that we've understood make some of the biggest impact, biggest needle movers on our physiology and our psychology by effect. So the first one being light. So we spend the first, that first kind of education week on light so that we can set this up so that they're actually practically applying this, not just like an idea. And then we go into darkness, the flip side of that. So changing over your environment so that you're getting ample darkness post sunset. We go into temperature. Temperature is a huge one. And also for many listeners, I can almost guarantee that people are saying, maybe, you know, I can fall asleep with these. It's the wake ups. I mean, the wake ups are probably one of the most common things that I get that people are frustrated about, or early morning wake ups. Sometimes it's all three. Sometimes it's difficulty falling asleep, waking up, and early morning wake ups, which can be really frustrating. But all of those things, temperature can be a huge aspect of that. So we go through that, what that looks like from the moment you wake up to, you know, throughout your entire night. Then we go through meal timing. We go through exercise timing. We go through thought timing, which is an area that we could discuss for what you shared. So we would look at the thought timing piece. And this is my forever area that I'm always trying to work on personally, is because I feel similar to you. Like, I always want to, let me just learn one more thing, read one more, you know, article, listen to one more podcast. So instead we try to run an audit system ongoingly and saying, like, okay, what is the effect likely to be? Because I'm just like you, have 9 million thoughts of, oh, maybe I could do this and thread this into the business and yada, yada. Is that serving us at particular times? So we look at that. And then the last one is known as chronopharmacology, the timing of our drugs, which sounds more layered, but our drugs could be our caffeine, our alcohol, THC. Now in modern life, some plant medicine drugs for some people, or just supplements or prescriptions. So kind of understanding what all these are doing and the times by which we want to be aware that we're taking those. So those are all kind of, that's the triage that we're going through. And all of those can then address some of these major needle movers to help really make a difference for people, no matter what they're dealing with. And there might be some for them that they need to really double down on. So like I said, for me, it's continuing forever. It's like a forever life mastery, this thought timing element, and really continuing to be facile in that commitment to ensure that we have a duality to our day, an excitatory part on the front half where we're engaged and we're having great conversations like this, and we're activating our certain elements of our brain. But then in the evening, really being committed to down regulation, helping to give ourselves enough runway by which we can transition from awake to sleep state.
Wow. There's so much great information you packed into that answer. And we're going to get into the, yes, we're going to get into, to just to recap, because there's so much there, I can't even recap it. We're going to get into your top picks, and maybe we'll just do a, we'll do a speed round towards the end, and we'll go back and forth of what we've both found works. You, of course, are probably going to win because you're the expert in this space. Before we get there, though, I've got a question for you that's been a burning question for me. And that is, you mentioned the Oura Ring. I've got the Oura Ring. I've got the Whoop strap. I've got the Apple Watch.
Yep.
I've got the Muse S, which measures EEG. Yep. I've got the Fourth Frontier that gives me an ECG that I can wear during sleep. I am got all sorts of data.
Yeah.
Everything disagrees in terms of my my sleep data, in terms of REM sleep, deep sleep, light sleep. Which is to be trusted? Do you find that one's more accurate than the other? How do we deal with the fact that we're getting different input from these different devices?
Yeah, such an important question. And it's actually been kind of spewing up in conversation more routinely, I think, because, for instance, with Oura Ring, they just pushed a new beta release where now suddenly their sleep staging looks totally different than it had before. And people are, you know, freaking out, really, saying, oh my God, I'm getting so much less deep sleep or REM or what have you. So I share that because I think it's super important that we have this conversation, because I've been trying to kind of scream this from the rooftops for a long time now, because I think so many people, even really, really knowledgeable people and thinkers in the health and wellness space, have unfortunately, seemingly unknowingly, been sharing their wearable data almost as if it's some sort of, you know, law or something, and acting as if they've been able to kind of find the way to fine tune sleep, but not realizing that out of all the hand and wrist based trackers, the least accurate data information are those sleep stage classifications, unequivocally. So the REM, the deep, the light sleep, all of that. If it's on the hand and wrist, or really anywhere but the brain, we're making our best guess onto what sleep stage we would be in, because our best understanding, say if you were to go into a sleep lab and be outfitted with a PSG, that's our kind of our gold standard for reading our kind of sleep results and understanding what sleep stage we're in throughout the course of the night. It's really the brain-based activity that we understand as of right now. And so all the other peripheral information is just, again, the algorithmic piece of trying to make our best guess. So you will lose your mind if you try to compare all these wearables. And I have so many kind of, you know, biohackers that will do that. And I totally get it. I mean, I've got every single type of wearable imaginable, and it can be very confusing. So it's just, you have to remember that the most important thing is within each wearable, their particular algorithm, and just noticing particular deviations is our best kind of takeaway for that. If there's major deviations from, say, like you normally are getting 2 hours of deep sleep and then suddenly you go down to 15 minutes, that would be potentially noteworthy. But you also have to remember that even with this, for instance, with Oura now, they're asserting that they're one of the more accurate sleep stage classification units on the market with their change. It's still only at 79% accuracy. So it's still, you know, there's room for improvement. And it's still amazing that we're putting in all this time, energy, and effort and getting improvements. But out of that data, I would have people really put the least energy into that space and instead look at some of the other indicators that we, one, know that there's higher accuracy around. So things like, are you asleep or are you awake? They're pretty good at that. So that's more than 90s percentage accuracy rate. So are you asleep or are you awake? Pretty good. Things like your heart rate, your HRV, heart rate variability. And if people aren't familiar with heart rate variability, one of the reasons that we like to pay attention to that one as it relates to sleep is the thinking is that HRV is kind of this metric of recovery and how well recovered you were throughout the course of the night, second to second, moment to moment, is presumably important data and to understand if there's something stressing our nervous system, our ability to recover. So that information, your body temperature, especially for women throughout their different parts of their cycle can be particularly noteworthy. Respiratory rate, things like blood oxygen, all of those can oftentimes, along with things like restlessness levels and frequency of wake-ups, can sometimes sound the alarm for kind of red flags enough to get tested for things like sleep apnea, upper airway resistance syndrome. So of course, they're not diagnostic, but they could give us enough clues that it's worth testing.
Absolutely. And if you do think you might have sleep apnea, that's one of the things where you need to go schedule a visit with your doctor, either your primary care physician or an ENT, because that can be a serious issue that needs to be addressed, correct?
Quick, because it's so important. I'm so glad you said that, because if anyone, one thing I've seen is that I don't know if there's fear around it or just feels like a lot to go into this in-lab place, or, you know, there's a lot of emotions with it, or just can feel maybe too expensive, too much time, energy, what have you. If any of that is keeping you from getting tested, do know that there are pretty good, just for sleep apnea, at least not for the over 80 different sleep disorders that actually are, that exist. But for at least around respiratory based sleep disorders, getting at home sleep tests can have some real validity too. And you can get them for around $200 now. You can go online, lots of different providers, Lofta and Power Sleep, Rest Assured. There's a lot of them. So you can, within, you know, like 48 hours, get yourself an at-home test and, you know, be able to just go to sleep like you'd usually do and get some understanding of what's going on if you have mild, moderate, severe sleep apnea. You know, and if from there, if there's still other questions, you can certainly, of course, go into a sleep lab, and that would always be ideal. But if it's between, if you're hesitating, that could be another step.
Great. That's great information. We're talking about all these devices. I can tell you're a data geek like I am.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, one of the other things I suffered from, I think you actually even said it, is a form of sleep neurosis. I'll call it sleep data neurosis. That I became so obsessed with all of these different data sources, I stopped sleeping. And one of these wearables, I won't say which one because I don't want to ping anybody specifically. Yes. But one of them had this sleep debt thing, and I found myself falling deeper and deeper into sleep debt. And man, that just messed with my mind to the point where I just like wasn't sleeping at all. So, do you find this in your practice with sleep optimization? Do you have people that maybe are obsessing too much on all this data?
100%. Yes. And it can be such a fine line. And interestingly, one thing, if there's a through line for some people that can get into the realm of identifying as having, you know, insomnia, or kind of sleep anxiety, sleep phobia, all these things are actual terms that people will use. It can become this hyperfixation on this area. Now, of course, I mean, I'm talking about sleep all day, every day. I am pretty fixated. However, part of one of the things, so going back to my example of when I went through this period of, you know, total sleep breakdown, really, which was during that time, I really did begin to identify as someone that was had almost sleep anxiety, or the sun would be setting and my heart would start racing of, oh, I can't face another night just laying and staring at the ceiling. You feel like you're just losing it. So with all that, of course, it makes a lot of sense that if you're going through some of that and you start to create this whole reality that maybe something's wrong with you, it's always going to be like this, you know, maybe there's some hidden thing, maybe some switch got switched and you're broken or something happened in your brain. Just a whole lot of narrative craziness can come about. So with that, of course, you want to fix it and you want it to not be that way. So you, it makes not just you, all of us can in those situations start looking for the solution and start hitching our hopes onto a pill, a gadget, a solution, or what have you. And part of the breakthrough for many of us is to both be able to prioritize sleep, set things up powerfully, but then also allow for it to just do its thing and us to practice this element of letting go and understanding that every night's not going to be perfect. And so it is this very weird paradoxical thing, especially for those of us who, you know, want to just gain the information and we want to, you know, have gain mastery in this area and can almost go into the realm of wanting to force sleep. And unfortunately, sleep and force don't go well together at all. So one analogy that I'm trying to remember, someone on our podcast, I wish I could attribute it better, but there was a person on our podcast that used this analogy that I really liked, which was around surfing and sleep. So the analogy was for great surfers, I'm not a great surfer, but apparently what they do is they'll do a lot of kind of prep to have a great, you know, kind of surfing experience. So they'll get the right gear, they'll get the right boards, they'll wax the, you know, thing, they'll get everything set up. They'll find out, they'll go on the, you know, weather, find out the weather, they'll find out the great spots to go. They'll park themselves there. They'll get all set up, but then they just go out into the ocean and then they allow the waves to come to them because you can never force the ocean to do anything. And so that's kind of the same way with sleep, is that what we like to do is to shift the paradigm from the focus on the nights to instead focusing on really life optimization in a lot of ways. And from the moment you first wake up, this ability to set yourself up powerfully and all these things that are going to really, as we often call it, a Trojan horse effect, that in order to improve your sleep, you're actually improving so many other areas of your life that maybe were like a nice to improve in the past, but now become this area that really can work in tandem for the results you're looking for. So suddenly you're working out more, you're managing your glucose, you are eating a particular way, you're managing your stress load, all of these other things that happen by day, and then the nights do whatever the nights do. But we have this trust that over time, as we make these improvements and we get more educated on some of the things that really can make a difference with our sleep, then we can have that faith that over time we'll see those positive trends.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting, Molly, I was listening to your podcast interview with Dr. Molly Maloof, and she just kind of mentioned something really quickly in her interview that was fascinating. It was actually something that I'd done too, to change the mindset around sleep. And that was, you know, in order to get out of that sleep neurosis, I was trying to think of what could I look forward to in sleep instead of, you know, thinking about all the things that could go wrong with sleep. And I thought about dreams. So I'm like, you know, I'm going to start a dream journal and just look forward to what I could remember in the morning about what was happening with my dreams. And it completely changed my mindset because I no longer was focusing on the negative. I was focusing on something that I might be able to get out of sleep that would actually be interesting to me. And if you haven't done this before, just get a notebook, put it by the side of your bed. When you wake up the morning, first thing before you do anything else, just take some notes of what you remember from your dreams. And you'll find some fascinating things if you do that. For me, it was like just the proximal nature of what happens in the day before and how those things appear in my dreams. And to me, it was like insight into how my brain was processing things that had happened the day before that I found very interesting and in a lot of cases useful. And then suddenly dreams were like really positive and something to look forward to, and I could only get during sleep. So now I'm almost excited to get to sleep versus thinking of sleep as an impediment to all the work that I want to get done.
Oh, I love that reframe. And that's such an opportunity to really transform our relationship to our sleep, because there is that experience of one of the things we often find for people as they go through this process of sleep optimization, a lot of it becomes this period of improving our sleep confidence and our trust that we are someone that can largely go to sleep and have that happen, have ourselves experience sleep routinely. And you'd be surprised the empowerment that that can bring for someone that for often maybe years they haven't experienced that for themselves. It's kind of like a roll of the dice. What's going to happen when they go into the bedroom? So oftentimes that can be linked up with all kinds of narratives and, you know, stress load or stress response going into that bedroom environment. So that becomes a really important piece of this, is starting to look at how has it been for me? What has the relationship been? And like you said, for you, like it might've been a whole slew of other, ways of thinking about sleep. And now on this other side, get to actually bring in this new realm of curiosity and interest and intrigue. And I mean, that's a whole new world that gets opened up. And I think that's really, really empowering. I love that point.
Yeah. And it's really helped. Before we get to our fast round though, a lot of you are wondering, why are we talking so much about sleep on a podcast devoted to glucose and wellness and weight loss? And, you know, I can tell you one of the reasons from the own experiments that I've done and the team has done, a great experiment for the listeners to try is, to Molly's point about these trillions of cells in our body and their circadian rhythm, take something to eat for breakfast. For me, it's oatmeal. I've mentioned it again. I've mentioned it in all 40 episodes so far. But, you know, I know that oatmeal, I'll only get like a spike of 10 milligrams per deciliter. If I take that bowl of oatmeal and eat it late at night, try it just once and see what happens to your blood glucose. Yeah. You get a completely different response. For me, it was a delta of 50 milligrams per deciliter spike.
Wow.
Because my gut, my microbiome really wasn't prepared. They're sleeping, for lack of a better term. Yes. They're on their circadian rhythm. They're turned off. They're not doing their job. So all that sugar, all those carbs were entering my system, where a lot of that microbiota might have been consuming some of that sugar and metabolizing that differently than it had first thing in the morning. So that, along with things like leptin and ghrelin, I know my listeners know these terms because we've talked about them all the time, about the satiety hormone and the hunger hormone can get messed up if you don't sleep well. So that's why sleep is so important. And I'm sure some of the people participating in sleep optimization through Molly's sleep as a skill probably experienced the same benefits there too, which is like a side benefit. Not only are you getting better sleep, but now maybe not as hungry, more satiated when you wake up, feeling more, of course, more energetic and alive because you've gotten a good night's sleep.
Oh, 100%. I love that you're pointing to that. And if we're also sharing our kind of guilty pleasures, mine is popcorn. And popcorn is like my thing. And I used to, back when I did all those things not to do for my sleep, I would in late into the night, big old bag of popcorn, you know, back then, maybe, who knows, might have a glass of wine, all these other things that are just not serving sleep. I would do all those things late into the evening, having no clue of the impact that that was having from a glucose perspective, but also from a sleep perspective and how those work intimately. And to your point of like, why are we talking about all this on a podcast connected with glucose? So important. So again, I mentioned that probably one of the most common things I get is people saying, "Ugh, just help me get rid of these wake ups. They're driving me nuts. 3 a.m., 2 a.m., 4 a.m., whatever they are for the person, these wake ups." One of the more common reasons that we find for people having these wake-ups is glucose instability and this crashing of glucose reliably, and then subsequent wake-ups in response. So, and of course, it's not the only reason, but it is a very common reason that many, many people don't realize. And like, for instance, we just closed completed our last round of our last cohort, and we were going through everyone sharing, you know, kind of, you know, how is life different? What's happened? All the things. And many people were saying, I had no idea that when I would go into a program around sleep, that I would suddenly become this like glucose Jedi and have all this awareness. And they're all wearing continuous glucose monitors, all, but many of them are wearing continuous glucose monitors, and got to see that they had no clue that throughout the course of the night, they were having this whole roller coaster happening. And by eliminating and flattening some of those curves, basically, then they were able to have this these stretches of sleep where they were uninterrupted that they never thought was possible for them. So it is a big, big component. And of course, we know this bidirectional relationship with glucose, that if you are getting insufficient sleep night after night, it is a huge pillar of the process of improving that metabolic health, is to get sufficient sleep so that you're not the next day running on just a higher resting glucose state night after night after night. And certainly this can get very layered. So for women of menstruating age, we might know that going into luteal, we might be more sensitive to some of these changes, and that can play a role. So that's going to be part of our strategy, is really understanding some of the kind of periods of risk in a particular way, or times that you might be craving of certain things or have different reactions at different times. And what you're speaking to too, about the difference with your oatmeal in the morning versus the oatmeal at night, it is fascinating for us to really consider that glucose exists on this circadian spectrum. And this is where I think this information around circadian health is going to just be game changing for people, because once you start to realize it, what do? Okay. So then you shift maybe your last bite of food. That's kind of what we, as far as the circadian code information that's come out of the Salk Institute, is looking at when is your first bite of food and when is your last bite of food, and starting to play with those from a bio-individual perspective, but really starting to notice what are the implications, what happens when you move that last bite of food just a little bit earlier, and what is a subsequent likelihood to happen with your sleep. What I see time and time again is that people's heart rate goes down when they move that last bite of food earlier. Their HRV goes up, their body temperature goes down, their respiratory rate goes down. And all of those can indicate just improved levels of recovery throughout the course of their night, simply by making that one little tweak. So it's a big, big component. So I'm so glad you're bringing attention.
Yeah, big one. And I'll just add something to that. And that is, a carby late meal combined with alcohol is probably the worst combination, because that alcohol and oxidative priority will usually delay your spike 2 to 3 hours. Yeah. So then you're spiking it, you know, depending on when you eat, but most likely in the middle of the night if you have those two. We only have a few minutes left. So real quick, top five sleep hacks. If you were to, like, you mentioned one, which I totally agree with. It's setting that sleep schedule and keeping to it. You mentioned so many others, but what would you say were your top five?
Sure. Okay. So I would definitely put that number one, is that consistent wake up time. Don't even in the beginning go too nuts on the bedtime, unless you're like advanced stage sleep optimization. But just even in the beginning, just play the game of your consistent wake up time, no matter what happens throughout the course of the night. And so that will really be huge. So that one. Then the second one, again, we know is light from a perspective of just its immense kind of drug-like effect that it has, almost a phototherapy effect. So use light like a drug. So in the mornings, you want to get really intense bright light exposure. And you have to remember that, so a lot of the people that go through our programs become connected to more of the physics of light, because you really have to understand that from this way of living where we're kind of zoo animals inside, blocked by all these windows, and maybe some people even not having, big clear sources of even the window piece. So the reason why I say all that is that largely inside On average, your amount of lux that you're exposed to in an indoor environment is usually around like 500 lux or so on average. You go outside, you can get, depending on the time of year and the time of day, you can get up to 50,000 lux, 60, 70, 80,000 or more, depending on where you are. That is a huge difference. That tells the body so much, and it's such a huge marker that we're not taking advantage of. So you do have to physically get outside each and every day, even if it's cloudy, even if it's cold. And unfortunately, if it's cloudy or cold, if you're in a northern latitude location, the kind of unfortunate information is that you actually want to be outside even longer on those days than just skipping it. So that's, and I'm from Maine, lived in New York for over a decade. I totally get it. And yet, you know, setting up life. So I've also been known to do really weird things. Like when I lived in New York, I would bundle up like in this parka, open up the window and physically get my head outside to get the light in my eyes. It doesn't have to look cool. You know, just do whatever it takes. And so get that light, high amplitude of light. Then the third one would be getting a incredibly dim evening post sunset. So ideally, we had a sleep anthropologist on the podcast who would challenge his, he's a professor and would challenge his students every single year, and barely anyone would do it, but hopefully a listener or two will do this. Take the candlelight challenge, where post sunset, you aren't using any faux lighting except for candlelight, and just see what happens to your sleep if you do that consistently for a while. It's often shocking the difference that can make in how people are getting sleepy earlier. And we have actual studies behind for the why of this. But so that could be an approach. If you're not interested in candles, you got kids, you got dogs, you got whatever. Red light, Himalayan salt lamps, Philips Hues, fire, all of these things can be options for you in the evening. So, and then another piece of that is while you're actually sleeping, getting total darkness in your sleep environment. So you want to do the hand test. So you put your hand in front of your face while you are in your bedroom. And if you can still see that hand, then we still have work to do to ensure. And until you can't see a single piece of that hand, we, you know, want to make sure that we make those changes, because it will really measurably help shift your sleep doing those steps. The fourth one, I would absolutely bring in this meal timing piece. Huge, huge, huge. And I find that it's one of the more challenging, honestly, behavioral change elements that I see for people, because they get to start to experience, oh my God, I slept so much better when I moved that last bite earlier. And yet it can be difficult with social obligations and what have you. So we're just trying to play with how can we almost turn everything upside down as far as our volume of food and timing, to front load our calories more on the front half of the day versus the back end. So eat like, you know, a king for breakfast, a queen for lunch, and a pauper for dinner was this old saying. You know, it's probably all kinds of problems with that saying now, but having said that, some version of just knowing that the volume changes and that you're just allowing yourself sufficient time to digest in the evening. And now I think we're at number five. So this is where I'd put like almost a wild card, depending on what's going on for the person. It sounds like for you and I, thought timing is likely going to be a big one to move the needle for us. So ensuring that we're not getting too excited into the evening or taking in too much information, or, you know, getting that brain, that beta brain state kind of going haywire, instead down regulating. And what would that look like? But as far as for other people, another wild card might be temperature, which is a huge one. So I would say one of the things that can make such a measurable difference on people's wearable stats are some element of cooling options for the bed. So eight sleep, chilly sleep, sleep number, any of these things that can physically cool not only just the environment, which I should absolutely say you want to cool the ambient sleep temperature that you have from anywhere from 60 to 67 degrees Fahrenheit is a suggestion from the Sleep Foundation, which many people are nowhere close to. So doing that and bringing in that cooling option within your bed, because you're just kind of cooking in there, because we've got, say, many of us have foam mattresses, and you've got the duvets on top of you, and you're just keeping all that heat inside there, when for thousands of years, we would have been sleeping on the physical ground, which would have been the coolest place in the, you know, entire environment. And so you would have almost had your own natural chili pad, eight sleep, all of that. And yet now we've taken ourselves outside of that. So that could be another piece to stand. But you also have to look at your own kind of bio-individuality and what's going on for you. If you're drinking, you know, glasses of wine, if you are have the habit of THC before bed, all of these different things, you want to get clear on what are some of those big pieces of kind of like kryptonite for you in your sleep, those sleep sabotagers, and make those subsequent changes for you.
Molly, I could have you on for like another 2-3 hours. Easy. I've got so many questions and you've got so much valuable information to share. How can people find you if they want to find out more about Molly Eastman and more about sleep as a skill?
Well, one, you are just a pleasure to speak with. I know we had our call beforehand a while back and we were just chat. I mean, it's clearly so much synergy and similar interests. So this is just a pleasure and hopefully a lot more to come. And we've got you coming on our podcast. So that's going to be amazing. So really excited to do that as well. But yes, for anyone that is listening to this conversation and saying some form of, oh yeah, I'd absolutely like to improve my sleep, or just be hopefully even on the beginnings of speculating, maybe there is something else I could be doing my sleep, wherever you are on the spectrum, the best thing to do is to go to sleepasaskill.com, and it acts as this bucket for a lot of different actions you can take. So you can get there and take a sleep assessment, and we'll get you tailored information back based around what's going on with your sleep. Sign you up for that sleep newsletter that we love sending out every Monday. And please, we encourage people to respond back to those. We get back to everyone on there. Also, if you have any cool sleep experiments that you're finding with your wearables or what have you, we'll often include those kind of screenshots and, you know, kind of shares in that newsletter. We have the weekly podcast that we get out lots of, you know, free information for people to improve their sleep. And then if you are struggling, we would love to work with you to support in that process of really getting on the ground with transforming what's going on with your sleep measurably from an objective perspective. And there would go through the 10-week long cohort or one-on-ones if you want more kind of hands-on support. So lots of different options so that our commitment is that we're really standing for what's possible in this realm of sleep and really transforming this conversation around sleep on the planet as, you know, this experience that sleep has kind of been this forgotten piece of wellness or kind of like, oh, nice to have, but, you know, maybe that's the thing that gets cut. And instead we want to shift that paradigm to this is the foundation by which you build all of these other, you know, endeavors with your health and well-being.
Awesome. Molly, thanks so much for being on. If you don't mind, we'd love to have you back on so we can get to those other 2 hours of questions that I have.
I would love that. Yes, let's do a part two.
Okay, awesome. Thanks so much for joining us on Body Signals.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of Body Signals. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to our feed. Also, please share this episode with your friends. For those of you who are not yet Signos members, go to Signos.com, Signos.com, and use the code BODYSIGNALS, all one word, to get your 15% discount on Signos. We look forward to seeing you on our next episode of Body Signals.